Clinton's foreign economic policy was in keeping with the nation's history, in which both major parties were more concerned for corporate interests than for the rights of working people here or abroad, and saw foreign aid as a political and economic tool more than as a humanitarian act. In November 1993, an Associated Press dispatch reported the phasing out of economic aid to 35 countries. The administrator for the Agency for International Development, J. Brian Atwood, explained, "We no longer need an AID program to purchase influence." A humanitarian organization, Bread for the World, said that most of the cuts would harm very poor countries and added, with some bitterness, that hunger, poverty, and environmental degradation were not priorities for the Clinton administration. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, both dominated by the United States, adopted a hard-nosed banker's approach to debt-ridden third-world countries. They insisted that these poor nations allocate a good part of their meager resources to repaying their loans to the rich countries at the cost of cutting social services to their already desperate populations. The emphasis in foreign economic policy was on the market economy and privatization. This forced the people of former Soviet bloc countries to fend for themselves in a supposedly free economy. Without the social benefits that they had received under the admittedly inefficient and oppressive former regimes, unregulated market capitalism turned out to be disastrous for people in the Soviet Union, who saw huge fortunes accumulated by a few and deprivation for the masses. The slogan of free trade became an important objective for the Clinton administration. And with the support of Republicans as well as Democrats, Congress enacted the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, with Mexico. This removed obstacles for corporate capital and goods to move freely back and forth across the Mexican-U.S. border. There was vigorous disagreement over the effects of NAFTA. Some economists claimed it would benefit the United States economy by opening up a larger Mexican market for the United States goods. Opponents, including the major trade unions, said there would be a loss of jobs for American workers as corporations moved their operations across the border to hire Mexicans at low pay. Two economists for the Institute for Policy Studies, examining NAFTA in early 1995, after a year of its operation, found that it had caused a net loss of 10,000 U.S. jobs. While more workers in Mexico were now hired by U.S. corporations that moved there, they were working at low wages, with lax enforcement of workers' rights and environmental standards. The claim of the United States to support free trade was hardly to be believed, since the government interfered with trade when this did not serve what it called the national interest, which was a euphemism for corporate interest. Thus, it went to lengths to prevent tomato growers in Mexico from entering the United States market. In an even more flagrant violation of the principle of free trade, the United States would not allow shipments of food or medicine to Iraq or to Cuba. In 1996, on the television program 60 Minutes, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, was asked about the report that 500,000 children died in Iraq as a result of sanctions. "That is more children than died in Hiroshima," she was asked. "Is the price worth it?" Albright replied, "I think this is a very hard choice. But the price, we think the price is worth it." The U.S. government did not seem to recognize that its punitive foreign policies, its military installations in countries all over the globe, might arouse anger in foreign countries, and that anger might turn to violence. When it did, the only response that the United States could think of was to react with more violence. Thus, when U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed in 1998, the Clinton administration responded by bombing targets in Afghanistan and the Sudan. The claim was that the Afghanistan target was a base for terrorist activity, although there was no proof of this. As for the Sudan, the United States insisted it had bombed a plant manufacturing chemical weapons, but it turned out to be a factory that produced medicines for half the population of the country. The human consequences of that loss of medicine could not be calculated. In that same year, Clinton faced the greatest crisis of his presidency. The nation learned that a young government worker, Monica Lewinsky, had been making secret visits to the White House for sexual liaisons with the president. This became a sensational story, occupying the front pages of newspapers for months. An independent counsel was appointed to investigate, who took lurid, detailed testimony from Monica Lewinsky, who had been exposed by a friend who had taped their conversations about sexual contact with Clinton. Clinton lied about his relationship with Lewinsky, and the House of Representatives voted to impeach him on the ground that he had lied in denying sexual relations with a young woman and that he had obstructed justice by trying to conceal information about their relationship. This was only the second time in American history that a president had been impeached. And here, too, as in the case of Andrew Johnson after the Civil War, the impeachment did not lead to the end of Clinton's presidency because the Senate did not vote for removal. What the incident showed was that a matter of personal behavior could crowd out of the public's attention far more serious matters, indeed, matters of life and death. The House of Representatives would impeach the president on matters of sexual behavior, but it would not impeach him for endangering the lives of children by welfare reform or for violating international law and bombing other countries, Iran, Afghanistan, Sudan, or for allowing hundreds of thousands of children to die as a result of economic sanctions in Iraq. In 1999, Clinton's last year in office, a crisis erupted in the Balkans that once again showed the United States government as disposed to use force rather than diplomacy in solving matters of international concern. The problem that arose came out of the breakup 10 years earlier of the Republic of Yugoslavia and the ensuing conflicts among the separated elements of a once united country. One of the parts of the former Yugoslavia was Bosnia-Herzegovina, with Croats massacring Serbs and Serbs massacring Croats and Muslims. After a vicious Serb attack on the city of Srebrenica, the United States bombed Serb positions, and then negotiations in Oslo, Norway, in 1995 stopped the fighting, dividing Bosnia-Herzegovina into Croat and Serbian entities. But the Oslo Accord had failed to deal with the problem of another part of the old Yugoslavia, the province of Kosovo, which, with a majority of its population Albanian and a minority being Serbian, was demanding independence from Serbia. The Serbian president, Slobodan Milosevic, had shown his ruthlessness earlier in Bosnia, and now, facing armed attack from Kosovo nationalists, attacked Kosovo, killing perhaps 2,000 people and causing several hundred thousand to become refugees. An international gathering in Rambouillet, France, was supposed to try to solve the problem diplomatically, but it presented terms to Yugoslavia that seemed certain to be rejected: NATO control of all of Kosovo and NATO military occupation of the rest of Yugoslavia. On March 23, 1999, the Serbian National Assembly responded with a counterproposal rejecting NATO occupation and calling for negotiations leading toward the reaching of a political agreement on a wide-ranging autonomy for Kosovo. The Serbian proposal was ignored and was not reported in the major newspapers of the United States. The following day, NATO forces, meaning mostly U.S. forces, began the bombing of Yugoslavia. Presumably, the bombing was to stop the ethnic cleansing of Kosovo, that is, the forcing of Albanians out of the province by death or intimidation. But after 2 weeks of bombing, the New York Times reported, April 5, 1999, that more than 350,000 have left Kosovo since March 24th. 2 months later, with the bombing still going on, the figure had risen to over 800,000. The bombing of Yugoslavia, including the capital city of Belgrade, apparently intended to unseat Milosevic, led to an untold number of civilian casualties. An email message came to the United States from a professor at the University of Nice. The little town of Aleksinac, 20 miles away from my hometown, was hit last night with full force. The local hospital was hit, and a whole street was simply wiped out. What I know for certain is 6 dead civilians and more than 50 badly hurt. There was no military target around whatsoever. The New York Times reporter, Stephen Erlanger, described the mounded rubble across narrow Zmjavjovina Street, where Alexander Milich, 37, died on Tuesday. Mr. Milich's wife, Vesna, 35, also died. So did his mother and his 2 children, Miljana, 15, and Vladimir, 11. All of them killed about noon when an errant NATO bomb obliterated their new house and the cellar in which they were sheltering. When a peace agreement was finally signed on June 3, 1999, it was a compromise between the Rambouillet Accord, which Yugoslavia had rejected, and the Serbian National Assembly proposal, which had never been seriously considered. Noam Chomsky, in his book, The New Military Humanism, examined in detail the events of that spring and concluded, "The outcome as of June 3rd suggests that diplomatic initiatives could have been pursued on March 23rd, averting a terrible human tragedy." But it seemed that the Clinton administration, like so many before it, Truman in Korea, Johnson in Vietnam, Bush in the Gulf War, chose military solutions when diplomatic ones were possible. The militarization of the nation, the huge military budgets, the maintenance of armed forces all over the world, the repeated use of weapons against other countries, meant that the resources available for human needs were not available. In one of his finer moments, President Dwight Eisenhower had said, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in a final sense a theft from those who are hungry and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed."